slanted smile, only this time there was absolutely no humor in it at all. Suddenly McVries looked furious, and Garrity was almost afraid of him.
"He's the one that's forgetting, this turkey here."
"I don't want to do it anymore," Olson said hollowly. "I'm sick of it."
"Raring to rip," McVries said, turning on him.
"Isn't that what you said? Fuck it, then. Why don't you just fall down and die, then?"
"Leave him alone," Garrity said.
"Listen, Ray. No, you listen. One Barkovich is enough. Let him do it his own way. No musketeers, remember?"
McVries smiled again.
"Okay, Garrity. You win."
Olson didn't say anything. He just kept picking them up and laying them down. Full dark had come by 6:30. Caribou, now only 6 miles away, could be seen on the horizon as a dim glow. There were few people along the road to see them into town. They seemed to have all gone home to supper. The mist was chilly around Ray Garrity's feet. It hung over the hills in ghostly limp banners. The stars were coming brighter overhead, Venus glowing steadily, the Dipper in its accustomed place. He had always been good at the constellations. He pointed out Cassiopeia to Pearson, who only grunted. He thought about Jan, his girl, and felt a twinge of guilt about the girl he had kissed earlier. He couldn't remember exactly what the girl had looked like anymore, but she had excited him. Putting his hand on her ass like that had excited him. What would have happened if he had tried to put his hand between her legs? He felt a clock spring of pressure in his groin that made him wince a little as he walked. Jan had long hair, almost to her waist. She was 16. Her breasts were not as big as those of the girl who had kissed him. He had played with her breasts a lot. It drove him crazy. She wouldn't let him make love to her, and he didn't know how to make her. She wanted to, but she wouldn't. Garrity knew that some boys could do that, could get a girl to go along, but he didn't seem to have quite enough personality, or maybe not quite enough will, to convince her. He wondered how many of the others here were virgins. Gribble had called the major a murderer. He wondered if Gribble was a virgin. He decided Gribble probably was. They passed the Caribou city limits. There was a large crowd there, and a news truck from one of the networks. A battery of lights bathed the road in a warm white glare. It was like walking into a sudden warm lagoon of sunlight, wading through it, and then emerging again. A fat newspaper man in a three-piece suit trotted along with them, poking his long-reach microphone at different walkers. Behind him, two technicians busily unreeled a drum of electric cable.
"How do you feel?"
"Okay, I guess I feel okay."
"Feeling tired?"
"Yeah, well, you know, yeah, but I'm still okay."
"What do you think your chances are now?"
"I don't know. Okay, I guess. I still feel pretty strong." He asked a big bull of a fellow, Scram, what he thought of the long walk. Scram grinned, said he thought it was the biggest fucking thing he'd ever seen, and the reporter made snipping motions with his fingers at the two technicians. One of them nodded back wearily. Shortly afterward, he ran out of microphone cable and began wending his way back toward the mobile unit, trying to avoid the tangles of unreeled cord. The crowd, drawn as much by the TV crew as by the long walkers themselves, cheered enthusiastically. Posters of the major were raised and lowered rhythmically on sticks so raw and new they were still bleeding sap. When the cameras panned over them, they cheered more frantically than ever and waved to Aunt Betty and Uncle Fred. They rounded a bend and passed a small shop where the owner, a little man wearing stained white, had set up a soft drink cooler with a sign over it which read, "On the House for the Long Walkers," courtesy of Ev's Market. A police cruiser was parked close by, and two policemen were patiently explaining to Ev, as they undoubtedly did every year, that that it was against the rules for spectators to offer any kind of aid or assistance, including soft drinks, to the walkers. They passed by the Caribou Paper Mills, Inc., a huge, soot-blackened building on a dirty river. The workers were lined up against the cyclone fences, cheering good-naturedly and waving. A whistle blew as the last of the walkers, Stebbins, passed by, and Garrity, looking back over his shoulder, saw them trooping inside again.
"Did he ask you?"
a strident voice inquired of Garrity. With a feeling of great weariness, Garrity looked down at Gary Barkovich.
"Did who ask me what?"
"The reporter, Dumbo. Did he ask you how you felt?"
"No, he didn't get to me." He wished Barkovich would go away. He wished the throbbing pain in the soles of his feet would go away.
"They asked me," Barkovich said. "You know what I told them?"
"Uh-uh."
"I told them I felt great,"
Barkovich said aggressively. The rain hat was still flopping in his back pocket.
"I told them I felt real strong. I told them I felt prepared to go on forever. And do you know what else I told them?"
"Oh, shut up," Pearson said.
"Who asked you, long, tall, and ugly?" Barkovich said.
"Go away," McVries said. "You give me a headache."
Insulted once more, Barkovich moved on up the line and grabbed Collie Parker.
"Did he ask you what?"
"Get out of here before I pull your fucking nose off and make you eat it," Collie Parker snarled.
Barkovich moved on quickly. The word on Collie Parker was that he was one mean son of a bitch.
"That guy drives me up the wall," Pearson said.
"He'd be glad to hear it," McVries said. "He likes it. He also told that reporter that he planned to dance on a lot of graves. He means it, too. That's what keeps him going."
"Next time he comes around, I think I'll trip him,"
Olson said. His voice sounded dull and drained.
"Tut, tut," McVries said. "Rule 8, no interference with your fellow walkers."
"You know what you can do with Rule 8,
Olson said with a pallid smile.
"Watch out," McVries grinned. "You're starting to sound pretty lively again."
By 7 p.m., the pace, which had been lagging very close to the minimum limit, began to pick up a little. It was cool, and if you walked faster, you kept warmer. They passed beneath the turnpike overpass, and several people cheered them around mouthfuls of Dunkin' Donuts from the glass-walled shop situated near the base of the exit ramp.
"We join up with the turnpike someplace, don't we?"
Baker asked. "In Old Town," Garrity said. "Approximately 120 miles. Harkness whistled through his teeth. Not long after that, they walked into downtown Caribou. They were 44 miles from their starting point. Chapter 4. Everyone was disappointed with Caribou. It was just like Limestone. The crowds were bigger, but otherwise, it was just another mill, pulp, and service town with a scattering of stores and gas stations, one shopping center that was having, according to the signs plastered everywhere, our annual walk-in for value sale, and a park with a war memorial in it. A small, evil-sounding high school band struck up the national anthem, then a medley of Sousa marches, and then, with taste so bad it was almost grisly, marching to Pretoria. The same woman who had made a fuss at the crossroads so far back turned up again. She was still looking for Percy. This time she made it through the police cordon and right onto the road. She pawed through the boys, unintentionally tripping one of them up. She was yelling for her Percy to come home now. The soldiers went for their guns, and for a moment it looked very much as if Percy's mom was going to buy herself an interference ticket. Then a cop got an arm lock on her and dragged her away. A small boy sat on a Keep Maine Tidy barrel and ate a hot dog and watched the cops put Percy's mom in a police cruiser. Percy's mom was the high point of going through Caribou.
What comes after Old Town, Ray? McVries asked.
I'm not a walking road map, Garrity said irritably. Banger, I guess. Then Augusta, then Kittery, and the state line about 330 miles from here, give or take. Okay? I'm picked clean.
Somebody whistled.
330 miles.
It's unbelievable, Harkness said gloomily.
The whole damn thing is unbelievable, McVries said.
I wonder where the Major is.
Shacked up in Augusta,
Olson said. They all grinned, and Garrity reflected how strange it was about the Major, who had gone from God to Mammon in just 10 hours. 95 left, but that wasn't even the worst anymore. The worst was trying to visualize McVries buying it, or Baker, or Harkness with his silly book idea. His mind shied away from the thought. Once Caribou was behind them, the road became all but deserted. They walked through a country crossroads with a single light pole rearing high above, spotlighting them and making crisp black shadows as they passed through the glare. Far away, a train whistle hooted. The moon cast a dubious light on the ground fog, leaving it pearly and opalescent in the fields. Garrity took a drink of water.
Warning! Warning, 12! This is your final warning, 12!
12 was a boy named Fenter who was wearing a souvenir t-shirt which read, I rode the Mount Washington Cog Railway. Fenter was licking his lips. The word was that his foot had stiffened up on him badly. When he was shot 10 minutes later, Garrity didn't feel much. He was too tired. He walked around Fenter. Looking down, he saw something glittering in Fenter's hand, a St. Christopher's medal.
If I get out of this, McVries said abruptly, you know what I'm going to do?
What? Baker asked.
Fornicate until my cock turns blue. I've never been so horny in my life as I am right this minute, at 7:45 on May 1st.
You mean it? Garrity asked.
I do, McVries assured. I could even get horny for you, Ray, if you didn't need a shave.
Garrity laughed.
Prince Charming, that's who I am, McVries said.
His hand went to the scar on his cheek and touched it.
Now all I need is a sleeping beauty. I could awake her with a biggie sloppy soul kiss, and the two of us would ride away into the sunset, at least as far as the nearest Holiday Inn.
Walk,
Olson said listlessly.
Huh?
Walk into the sunset.
Walk into the sunset, okay, McVries said. True love, either way.
Do you believe in true love, Hank, dear?
I believe in a good screw,
Olson said, and Art Baker burst out laughing.
I believe in true love, Garrity said, and then felt sorry he had said it. It sounded naive.
You want to know why I don't?
Olson said. He looked up at Garrity and grinned a scary, furtive grin.
Ask Fenter. Ask Zuck, they know.
That's a hell of an attitude, Pearson said.
He had come out of the dark from some place and was walking with them again. Pearson was limping, not badly, but very obviously limping.
No, it's not, McVries said,
and then, after a moment, he added cryptically, Nobody loves a debtor.
Edgar Allan Poe did, Baker said.
I did a report on him in school, and it said he had tendencies that were necrophiliac,
Garrity said.
Yeah, that's right.
What's that? Pearson asked.
It means you get an urge to sleep with a dead woman, Baker said.
Or a dead man, if you're a woman.
Or if you're a fruit, McVries put in.
How the hell did we get on this?
Olson croaked.
Just how in the hell did we get on the subject of screwing dead people? It's fucking repulsive.
Why not?
A deep, somber voice said. It was Abraham, too. He was tall and disjointed looking. He walked in a perpetual shamble.
I think we all might take a moment or two to stop and think about whatever kind of sex life there may be in the next world.
I get Marilyn Monroe, McVree said. You can have Eleanor Roosevelt, Abe, old buddy.
Abraham gave him the finger. Up ahead, one of the soldiers droned out a warning.
Just a second now. Just one motherfucking second here.
Olson spoke slowly, as if he wrestled with a tremendous problem in expression.
You're all off the subject. All off.
The Transcendental Quality of Love, a lecture by the noted philosopher and Ethiopian jug rammer, Henry Olson, McVree said. Author of A Peach Is Not a Peach Without a Pit, and other works of
Wait!
Olson cried out. His voice was as shrill as broken glass.
You wait just one goddamn second! Love is a put-on! It's nothing! One big fat El Zilcho! You got it?
No one replied. Garrity looked out ahead of him, where the dark charcoal hills met the star-punched darkness of the sky. He wondered if he couldn't feel the first faint twinges of a Charlie horse in the arch of his left foot.
I want to sit down, he thought irritably. Damn it all, I want to sit down. Love is a fake,
Olson was blaring.
There are three great truths in the world, and they are a good meal, a good screw, and a good shit, and that's all. And when you get like Fenter and Zuck...
Shut up, a bored voice said, and Garrity knew it was Stebbins.
But when he looked back, Stebbins was only looking at the road and walking along near the left-hand edge. A jet passed overhead, trailing the sound of its engines behind it, and chalking a feathery line across the night sky. It passed low enough for them to be able to see its running lights, pulsing yellow and green. Baker was whistling again. Garrity let his eyelids drop mostly shut. His feet moved on their own. His half-dozing mind began to slip away from him. Random thoughts began to chase each other lazily across its field. He remembered his mother singing him an Irish lullaby when he was very small. Something about cockles and muscles, alive, alive-o, and her face, so huge and beautiful, like the face of an actress on a movie screen. Wanting to kiss her and be in love with her for always. When he grew up, he would marry her. This was replaced by Jan's good-humored Polish face and her dark hair that streamed nearly to her waist. She was wearing a two-piece bathing suit beneath a short beach coat because they were going to Reed Beach. Garrity himself was wearing a ragged pair of denim shorts and his Zoris. Jan was gone. Her face became that of Jimmy Owens, the kid down the block from them. He had been five, and Jimmy had been five, and Jimmy's mother had caught them playing doctor's office in the sandpit behind Jimmy's house. They both had boners. That's what they called them, boners. Jimmy's mother had called his mother, and his mother had come to get him and had sat him down in her bedroom and asked him how he would like it if she made him go out and walk down the street with no clothes on. His dozing body contracted with the groveling embarrassment of it, the deep shame. He had cried and begged not to make him walk down the street with no clothes on, and not to tell his father. 7 years old now, he and Jimmy Owens peering through the dirt-grimed window of the Burrs Building Materials office at the Naked Lady calendars, knowing what they were looking at, but not really knowing, feeling a crawling, shameful, exciting pang of something. Of something. There had been one blonde lady with a piece of blue silk draped across her hips, and they had stared at it for a long, long time. They argued about what might be down there under the cloth. Jimmy said he had seen his mother naked. Jimmy said he knew. Jimmy said it was hairy and cut open. He had refused to believe Jimmy,
because what Jimmy said was disgusting. Still, he was sure that ladies must be different from men down there, and they had spent a long purple summer dusk discussing it, swatting mosquitoes and watching a scratch baseball game in the lot of the moving van company across the street from Burr's. He could feel, actually feel, in the half-waking dream the sensation of the hard curb beneath his fanny. The next year he had hit Jimmy Owens in the mouth with the barrel of his Daisy air rifle while they were playing guns, and Jimmy had to have 4 stitches in his upper lip. A year after that, they had moved away. He hadn't meant to hit Jimmy in the mouth. It had been an accident. Of that he was quite sure, even though by then he had known Jimmy was right because he had seen his own mother naked. He had not meant to see her naked. It had been an accident. They were hairy down there. Hairy and cut open.
Shh, it isn't a tiger, love. Only your teddy bear, see? Cockles and muscles, alive, alive, oh. Mother loves her boy. Shh, go to sleep.
Warning! Warning, 47!
An elbow poked him rudely in the ribs.
That was you, boy. Rise and shine. McVries was grinning at him.
What time is it?
Garrity asked thickly.
8:35.
But I've been...
dozing for hours, McVries said. I know the feeling.
Well, it sure seemed that way.
It's your mind, McVries said. Using the old escape hatch. Don't you wish your feet could?
I use style, Pearson said, pulling an idiotic face. Don't you wish everybody did?
Garrity thought that memories were like a line drawn in the dirt. The further back he went, the scuffier and harder to see that line got. Until finally there was nothing but smooth sand and the black hole of nothingness that you came out of. The memories were in a way like the road. Here it was real and hard and tangible. But that early road, that 9 in the morning road, was far back and meaningless. They were almost 50 miles into the walk. The word came back that the major would be by in his jeep to review them and make a short speech when they actually got to the 50-mile point. Garrity thought that was most probably horseshit. They breasted a long, steep rise, and Garrity was tempted to take his jacket off again. He didn't. He unzipped it, though, and then walked backward for a minute. The lights of Caribou twinkled at him, and he thought about Lot's wife, who had looked back and turned into a pillar of salt.
Warning! Warning, 47! Second warning, 47!
It took Garrity a moment to realize it was him. His second warning in 10 minutes. He started to feel afraid again. He thought of the unnamed boy who had died because he had slowed down once too often. Was that what he was doing? He looked around. McVries, Harkness, Baker, and Olson were all staring at him. Olson was having a particularly good look. He could make out the intent expression on Olson's face, even in the dark. Olson had outlasted 6. He wanted to make Garrity lucky 7. He wanted Garrity to die.
See anything green? Garrity asked irritably.
No,
Olson said, his eyes sliding away.
Course not.
Garrity walked with determination now, his arms swinging aggressively. It was 20-9. At 20-11, 8 miles down the road, he would be free again. He felt an hysterical urge to proclaim he could do it. They needn't send the word back on him. They weren't going to watch him get a ticket. At least, not yet. The ground fog spread across the road in thin ribbons, like smoke. The shapes of the boys moved through it, like dark islands somehow set adrift. At 50 miles into the walk, they passed a small, shut-up garage with a rusted-out gas pump in front. It was little more than an ominous, leaning shape in the fog. The clear fluorescent light from a telephone booth cast the only glow. The major didn't come. No one came.
The road dipped gently around a curve, and then there was a yellow road sign ahead. The word came back, but before it got to Garrity, he could read the sign for himself. Steep grade, trucks use low gear. Groans and moans. Somewhere up ahead, Barkovich called out merrily,
"Step into it, brothers! Who wants to race me to the top?"
"Shut your goddamn mouth, you little freak," someone said quietly.
"Make me, Dumbo," Barkovich shrilled. "Come on up here and make me."
"He's cracking," Baker said.
"No," McVries replied. "He's just stretching. Guys like him have an awful lot of stretch."
Olson's voice was deadly quiet.
"I don't think I can climb that hill. Not at 4 miles an hour."
The hill stretched above them. They were almost to it now. With the fog, it was impossible to see the top. "For all we know, it might just go up forever," Garrity thought. They started up. It wasn't as bad, Garrity discovered, if you stared down at your feet as you walked and leaned forward a little. You stared strictly down at the tiny patch of pavement between your feet, and it gave you the impression that you were walking on level ground. Of course, you couldn't kid yourself that your lungs and the breath in your throat weren't heating up, because they were. Somehow the word started coming back. Some people still had breath to spare, apparently. The word was that this hill was a quarter of a mile long. The word was that it was 2 miles long. The word was that no walker had ever gotten a ticket on this hill. The word was that 3 boys had gotten tickets here just last year, and after that, the word stopped coming back.
"I can't do it," Olson was saying monotonously. "I can't do it anymore."
His breath was coming in dog-like pants. He kept on walking, and they all kept on walking. Little grunting noises and soft, plosive breathing became audible. The only other sounds were Olson's chant, the scuff of many feet, and the grinding, ratcheting sound of the half-track's engine as it chugged along beside them. Garrity felt the bewildered fear in his stomach grow. He could actually die here. It wouldn't be hard at all. He had screwed around and had gotten 2 warnings on him already. He couldn't be much over the limit right now. All he had to do was slip his pace a little, and he'd have number 3. Final warning.
And then...
"Warning! Warning, 70!
"They're playing your song, Olson,"
McVries said between pants.
"Pick up your feet. I want to see you dance up this hill like Fred Astaire." "What do you care?"
Olson asked fiercely. McVries didn't answer. Olson found a little more inside himself and managed to pick it up. Garrity wondered morbidly if the little more Olson had found was his last legs. He also wondered about Stebbins, back there tailing the group. "How are you, Stebbins? Getting tired?" Up ahead, a boy named Larson, 60, suddenly sat down on the road. He got a warning. The other boys split and passed around him like the Red Sea around the children of Israel.
"I'm just going to rest for a while, okay?"
Larson said with a trusting, shell-shocked smile.
"I can't walk anymore right now, okay?"
His smile stretched wider, and he turned it on the soldier who had jumped down from the half-track with his rifle unslung and the stainless steel chronometer in his left hand.
"Warning, 60, the soldier said. "Second warning."
"Listen, I'll catch up,"
Larson hastened to assure him.
"I'm just resting. A guy can't walk all the time. Not all the time. Can he, fellas?"
Olson made a little moaning noise as he passed Larson and shied away when Larson tried to touch his pants cuffs. Garrity felt his pulse beating warmly in his temples. Larson got his 3rd warning. "Now he'll understand," Garrity thought. "Now he'll get up and start flogging it." And at the end,
Larson did realize, apparently. Reality came crashing back in.
Hey!
Larson said behind them. His voice was high and alarmed.
Hey, just a second! Don't do that! I'll get up! Hey, don't!
The shot. They walked on up the hill.
93 bottles of beer left on the shelf, McVree said softly.
Garrity made no reply. He stared at his feet and walked and focused all of his concentration on getting to the top without that third warning. It couldn't go on much longer, this monster hill. Surely not. Up ahead, someone uttered a high, gobbling scream, and the rifles crashed in unison.
Barkovich, Baker said hoarsely. That was Barkovich. I'm sure it was.
Wrong, redneck,
Barkovich yelled out of the darkness.
100% dead wrong.
They never did see the boy who had been shot after Larson. He had been part of the vanguard, and he was dragged off the road before they got there. Garrity ventured a look up from the pavement and was immediately sorry. He could see the top of the hill, just barely. They still had the length of a football field to go. It looked like 100 miles. No one said anything else. Each of them had retreated into his own private world of pain and effort. Seconds seemed to telescope into hours. Near the top of the hill, a rutted dirt road branched off the main drag, and a farmer and his family stood there. They watched the walkers go past. An old man with a deeply seamed brow, a hatchet-faced woman in a bulky cloth coat, 3 teenage children who all looked half-witted.
All he needs is a pitchfork,
McVree's told Garrity breathlessly. Sweat was streaming down McVree's face.
And Grant Wood to paint him.
Someone called out.
Hiya, Daddy.
The farmer and the farmer's wife and the farmer's children said nothing. The cheese stands alone, Garrity thought crazily. Hi-ho the Dario, the cheese stands alone. The farmer and his family did not smile. They did not frown. They held no signs. They did not wave. They watched. Garrity was reminded of the Western movies he had seen on all the Saturday afternoons of his youth, where the hero was left to die in the desert and the buzzards came and circled overhead. They were left behind, and Garrity was glad. He supposed the farmer and his wife and the 3 half-witted children would be out there around 9 o'clock next May 1st, and the next, and the next. How many boys had they seen shot? 12? 2? Garrity didn't like to think of it. He took a pull at his canteen, sloshed the water around in his mouth, trying to cut through the caked saliva. He spit the mouthful out. The hill went on. Up ahead, Toland fainted and was shot after the soldier left beside him had warned his unconscious body 3 times. It seemed to Garrity that they had been climbing the hill for at least a month now. Yes, it had to be a month at least, and that was a conservative estimate because they had been walking for just over 3 years. He giggled a little, took another mouthful of water, sloshed it around in his mouth, and then swallowed it. No cramps. A cramp would finish him now, but it could happen. It could happen because someone had dipped his shoes in liquid lead while he wasn't looking. 9 gone, and 1/3 of them had gotten it right here on this hill. The major had told Olson to give them hell, and if this wasn't hell, it was a pretty good approximation. A pretty good...
Oh, boy.
Garrity was suddenly aware that he felt quite giddy, as if he might faint himself. He brought 1 hand up and slapped himself across the face, backward and forward, hard. You all right? McVree's asked.
Feel faint.
Pour your, quick whistling breath,
canteen over your head.
Garrity did it. I christen thee Raymond Davis Garrity, pox vobiscum. The water was very cold. He stopped, feeling faint. Some of the water trickled down inside his shirt in freezing cold rivulets.
"Canteen, 47!"
he shouted. The effort of the shout left him feeling drained all over again. He wished he had waited a while. One of the soldiers jog-trotted over to him and handed him a fresh canteen. Garrity could feel the soldier's expressionless marble eyes sizing him up.
"Get away," he said rudely, taking the canteen. "You get paid to shoot me, not to look at me."
The soldier went away with no change of expression. Garrity made himself walk a little faster. They kept climbing, and no one else got it. And then they were at the top. It was 9 o'clock. They had been on the road 12 hours. It didn't mean anything. The only thing that mattered was the cool breeze blowing over the top of the hill, and the sound of a bird, and the feel of his damp shirt against his skin, and the memories in his head. Those things mattered, and Garrity clung to them with desperate awareness. They were his things, and he still had them.
"Pete?"
"Yeah?"
"Man, I'm glad to be alive."
McVries didn't answer. They were on the downslope now. Walking was easy. "I'm going to try hard to stay alive," Garrity said, almost apologetically. The road curved gently downward. They were still 115 miles from Old Town and the comparative levelness of the turnpike.
"That's the idea, isn't it?"
McVries asked finally. His voice sounded cracked and cobwebby, as if it had issued from a dusty cellar. Neither of them said anything for a while. No one was talking. Baker ambled steadily along, he hadn't drawn a warning yet, with his hands in his pockets, his head nodding slightly with the flat-footed rhythm of his walk. Olson had gone back to Hail Mary, full of grace. His face was a white splotch in the darkness. Harkness was eating.
"Garrity?" McVries said.
"I'm here."
"You ever see the end of a long walk?"
"No."
"You?" "Hell no. I just thought you being close to it and all."
"My father hated them. He took me to one as a, what do you call it, object lesson. But that was the only time."
"I saw."
Garrity jumped at the sound of that voice. It was Stebbins. He had pulled almost even with them, his head still bent forward, his blonde hair flapping around his ears like a sickly halo.
"What was it like?"
McVries asked. His voice was younger somehow.
"You don't want to know," Stebbins said.
"I asked, didn't I?"
Stebbins made no reply. Garrity's curiosity about him was stronger than ever. Stebbins hadn't folded up. He showed no signs of folding up. He went on without complaint and hadn't been warned since the starting line.
"Yeah, what's it like?" he heard himself asking.
"I saw the end 4 years ago, Stebbins said. "I was 13. It ended about 16 miles over the New Hampshire border. They had the National Guard out and 16 federal squads to augment the state police. They had to. The people were packed 60 deep on both sides of the road for 50 miles. Over 20 people were trampled to death before it was all over. It happened because people were trying to move with the walkers, trying to see the end of it. I had a front row seat. My dad got it for me."
"What does your dad do?" Garrity asked.
"He's in the squads, and he had it figured just right. I didn't even have to move. The walk ended practically in front of me."
"What happened?"
Olson asked softly.
"I could hear them coming before I could see them. We all could. It was one big sound wave getting closer and closer, and it was still an hour before they got close enough to see. They weren't looking at the crowd, either of the two that were left. It was like they didn't even know the crowd was there. What they were looking at was the road. They were hobbling along, both of them, like they had been crucified and then taken down and made to walk with the nails still through their feet. They were all listening to Stebbins now. A horrified silence had fallen like a rubber sheet. The crowd was yelling at them, almost as if they could still hear. Some were yelling one guy's name, and some were yelling the other guy's. But the only thing that really came through was this, "Go, go, go," chant. I was getting shoved around like a beanbag. The guy next to me either pissed himself or jacked off in his pants. You couldn't tell which. They walked right past me. One of them was a big blonde with his shirt open. One of his shoe soles had come unglued or unstitched or whatever, and it was flapping. The other guy wasn't even wearing his shoes anymore. He was in his stocking feet. His socks ended at his ankles. The rest of them, why, he'd just walked them away, hadn't he? His feet were purple. You could see the broken blood vessels in his feet. I don't think he really felt it anymore. Maybe they were able to do something with his feet later. I don't know. Maybe they were. "Stop it, for God's sake, stop it." It was McVries. He sounded dazed and sick. "You wanted to know," Stebbins said, almost genially. "Didn't you say that?" No answer. The half-track whined and clattered and spurted along the shoulder, and somewhere farther up, someone drew a warning. It was the big blonde that lost. I saw it all. They were just a little past me. He threw both of his arms up, like he was Superman. But instead of flying, he just fell flat on his face, and they gave him his ticket after 30 seconds because he was walking with three. They were both walking with three. Then the crowd started to cheer. They cheered and they cheered, and then they could see that the kid that won was trying to say something. So they shut up. He had fallen on his knees, you know, like he was going to pray, only he was just crying. And then he crawled over to the other boy and put his face in that big blonde kid's shirt. Then he started to say whatever it was he had to say, but we couldn't hear it. He was talking into the dead kid's shirt. He was telling the dead kid. Then the soldiers rushed out and told him he had won the prize and asked him how he wanted to start. "What did he say?" Garrity asked. It seemed to him that with the question, he had laid his whole life on the line. "He didn't say anything to them, not then," Stebbins said. "He was talking to the dead kid. He was telling the dead kid something, but we couldn't hear it."
"What happened then?" Pearson asked.
"I don't remember," Stebbins said remotely. No one said anything. Garrity felt a panicked, trapped sensation, as if someone had stuffed him into an underground pipe that was too small to get out of. Up ahead, a third warning was given out, and a boy made a croaking, despairing sound, like a dying crow. "Please, God, don't let them shoot anyone now," Garrity thought. "I'll go crazy if I hear the guns now. Please, God, please, God." A few minutes later, the guns rammed their steel death sound into the night. This time it was a short boy in a flapping red and white football jersey. For a moment, Garrity thought Percy's mom would not have to wonder or worry anymore, but it wasn't Percy. It was a boy named Quincy, or Quentin, or something like that. Garrity didn't go crazy. He turned around to say angry words at Stebbins, to ask him, perhaps, how it felt to inflict a boy's last minutes with such a horror. But Stebbins had dropped back to his usual position, and Garrity was alone again. They walked on.
the 90 of them. Chapter 5. At 10:20 on that endless May 1st, Garrity sloughed one of his two warnings. Two more walkers had bought it since the boy in the football jersey. Garrity barely noticed. He was taking a careful inventory of himself. One head, a little confused and crazied up, but basically okay. Two eyes, grainy. One neck, pretty stiff. Two arms, no problem there. One torso, okay except for a gnawing in his gut that concentrates couldn't satisfy. Two damn tired legs, muscles aching. He wondered how far his legs would carry him on their own, how long before his brain took them over and began punishing them, making them work past any sane limit to keep a bullet from crashing into his own bony cradle. How long before the legs began to kink and then to bind up, to protest and finally to seize up and stop. His legs were tired, but so far as he could tell, still pretty much okay. And 2 feet. Aching. They were tender, no use denying it. He was a big boy. Those feet were shifting 160 pounds back and forth. The soles ached. There were occasional strange shooting pains in them. His left great toe had poked through his sock. He thought of Stebbins's tail and felt a kind of creeping horror at that, and had begun to rub uncomfortably against his shoe. But his feet were working. There were still no blisters on them, and he felt his feet were still pretty much okay, too. Garrity, he pep-talked himself, you're in good shape. 12 guys dead, twice that many, maybe hurting bad by now, but you're okay. You're going good. You're great. You're alive. Conversation, which had died violently at the end of Stebbins's story, picked up again. Talking was what living people did. Yannick, 98, was discussing the ancestry of the soldiers on the half-track in an overloud voice with Wyman, 97. Both agreed that it was mixed, colorful, hirsute, and bastardized. Pearson, meanwhile, abruptly asked Garrity, "Ever have an enema?" "Anima?" Garrity repeated. He thought about it. "No, I don't think so." "Any of you guys?" Pearson asked. "Tell the truth now." "I did," Harkness said, and chuckled a little. "My mother gave me one after Halloween once, when I was little. I ate pretty near a whole shopping bag of candy." "Did you like it?" Pearson pressed. "Hell no! Who in hell would like a half a quart of warm soap suds up your—" "My little brother," Pearson said sadly. "I asked the little snot if he was sorry I was going, and he said no, because Ma said he could have an enema if he was good and didn't cry. He loves them." "That's sickening," Harkness said loudly. Pearson looked glum. "I thought so too." A few minutes later, Davidson joined the group and told them about the times he got drunk at the Steubenville State Fair and crawled into the Hoochie Cooch tent and got biffed in the head by a big fat mama wearing nothing but a G-string. When Davidson told her, so he said, that he was drunk and thought it was the tattooing tent he was crawling into, the red-hot big fat mama let him feel her up for a while, so he said. He had told her he wanted to get a stars and bars tattooed on his stomach. Art Baker told them about a contest they'd had back home to see who could light the biggest fart, and this hairy-assed old boy named Davy Popham had managed to burn off almost all the hair on his ass and the small of his back as well. Smelled like a grass fire, Baker said. This got Harkness laughing so hard he drew a warning. After that, the race was on. Tall story followed tall story until the whole shaky structure came tumbling down. Someone else was warned, and not long after, the other baker, James, bought a ticket.
The good humor went out of the group. Some of them began to talk about their girlfriends, and the conversation became stumbling and maudlin. Garrity said nothing about Jan, but as tired 10 o'clock came rolling in, a black coal sack splattered with milky ground mist, it seemed to him that she was the best thing he had ever known. They passed under a short string of mercury streetlights, through a closed and shuttered town, all of them subdued now, speaking in low murmurs. In front of the Shopwell, near the far end of this wide place in the road, a young couple sat asleep on a sidewalk bench with their heads leaning together. A sign that could not be read dangled between them. The girl was very young, she looked no more than 14, and her boyfriend was wearing a sports shirt that had been washed too many times to ever look very sporty again. Their shadows in the street made a merge that the walkers passed quietly over. Garrity glanced back over his shoulder, quite sure that the rumble of the half-track must have awakened them. But they still slept, unaware that the event had come and passed them by. He wondered if the girl would catch what for from her old man. She looked awfully young. He wondered if their sign was for Go Go Garrity, Maine's Own. Somehow, he hoped not. Somehow, the idea was a little repulsive. He ate the last of his concentrates and felt a little better. There was nothing left for Olson to cadge off him now. It was funny about Olson. Garrity would have bet 6 hours ago that Olson was pretty well done in. But he was still walking, and now without warnings. Garrity supposed a person could do a lot of things when his life was at stake. They had come about 54 miles now. The last of the talk died with the nameless town. They marched in silence for an hour or so, and the chill began to seep into Garrity again. He ate the last of his mom's cookies, balled up the foil, and pitched it into the brush at the side of the road. Just another litter bug on the great tomato plant of life. McVries had produced a toothbrush, of all things, from his small pack sack, and was busy dry-brushing his teeth. It all goes on, Garrity thought wonderingly. You burp, you say excuse me. You wave back at the people who wave to you because that's the polite thing to do. No one argues very much with anyone else, except for Barkovich, because that's also the polite thing to do. It all goes on. Or did it? He thought of McVries sobbing at Stebbins to shut up, of Olson taking his cheese with the dumb humility of a whipped dog. It all seemed to have a heightened intensity about it, a sharper contrast of colors and light and shadow. At 11 o'clock, several things happened almost at once. The word came back that a small plank bridge up ahead had been washed out by a heavy afternoon thunderstorm. With the bridge out, the walk would have to be temporarily stopped. A weak cheer went up through the ragged ranks, and Olson, in a very soft voice, muttered, "Thank God." A moment later, Barkovich began to scream a flood of profanity at the boy next to him, a squat, ugly boy with the unfortunate name of Rank. Rank took a swing at him, something expressly forbidden by the rules, and was warned for it. Barkovich didn't even break stride. He simply lowered his head and ducked under the punch and went on yelling.
Come on, you son of a bitch! I'll dance on your goddamn grave! Come on, Dumbo, pick up your feet! Don't make it too easy for me!
Rank threw another punch. Barkovich nimbly stepped around it, but tripped over the boy walking next to him. They were both warned by the soldiers, who were now watching the developments carefully, but emotionlessly, like men watching a couple of ants squabbling over a crumb of bread, Garrity thought bitterly. Rank started to walk faster, not looking at Barkovich. Barkovich himself, furious at being warned, the boy he had tripped over was Gribble, who had wanted to tell the major he was a murderer, yelled at him,
Your mother sucks cock on 42nd Street, Rank!
With that, Rank suddenly turned around and charged Barkovich. Cries of,
Break it up!
And,
Cut the shit! Filled the air, but Rank took no notice. He went for Barkovich with his head down, bellowing. Barkovich sidestepped him. Rank went stumbling and pinwheeling across the soft shoulder, skidded in the sand, and sat down with his feet splayed out. He was given a third warning.
Come on, Dumbo, Barkovich goaded. Get up!
Rank did get up. Then he slipped somehow and fell over on his back. He seemed dazed and woozy. The third thing that happened around 11 o'clock was Rank's death. There was a moment of silence when the carbine sighted in, and Baker's voice was loud and clearly audible. There, Barkovich, you're not a pest anymore. Now you're a murderer. The guns roared. Rank's body was thrown into the air by the force of the bullets. Then it lay still and sprawled, one arm on the road.
It was his own fault, Barkovich yelled. You saw him. He swung first. Rule 8, Rule 8.
No one said anything.
Go fuck yourselves, all of you,
McVries said easily. Go on back and dance on him a little, Barkovich. Go entertain us. Boogie on him a little bit, Barkovich.
Your mother sucks cock on 42nd Street too, Scarface, Barkovich said hoarsely.
Can't wait to see your brains all over the road, McVries said quietly. His hand had gone to the scar and was rubbing, rubbing, rubbing. I'll cheer when it happens, you murdering little bastard. Barkovich muttered something else under his breath. The others had shied away from him as if he had the plague and he was walking by himself. They hit 60 miles at about 10 past 11, with no sign of a bridge of any kind. Garrity was beginning to think the grapevine had been wrong this time when they cleared a small hill and looked down into a pool of light where a small crowd of hustling, bustling men moved. The lights were the beams of several trucks, directed at a plank bridge spanning a fast-running rill of water.
Truly, I love that bridge, Olson said, and helped himself to one of McVree's cigarettes. Truly.
But as they drew closer, Olson made a soft, ugly sound in his throat and pitched the cigarette away into the weeds. One of the bridge's supports and two of the heavy butt planks had been washed away, but the squad up ahead had been working diligently. A sawed-off telephone pole had been planted in the bed of the stream, anchored in what looked like a gigantic cement plug. They hadn't had a chance to replace the butts, so they had put down a big convoy truck tailgate in their place. Makeshift, but it would serve.
The bridge of San Luis Rey, Abraham said. Maybe if the ones up front stomp a little, it'll collapse again.
Small chance, Pearson said, and then added in a breaking, weepy voice. Aw, shit.
The vanguard, down to 3 or 4 boys, was on the bridge now. Their feet clumped hollowly as they crossed. Then they were on the other side, walking without looking back. The half-track stopped. 2 soldiers jumped out and kept pace with the boys. On the other side of the bridge, 2 more fell in with the vanguard. The boards rumbled steadily now. 2 men in corduroy coats leaned against a big asphalt-spattered truck marked Highway Repair. They were smoking. They wore green gum-rubber boots. They watched the walkers go by. As Davidson, McVries, Olson, Pearson, Harkness, Baker, and Garrity passed in a loose sort of group, one of them flicked his cigarette end over end into the stream and said,
"That's him. That's Garrity."
"Keep going, boy," the other yelled. "I got 10 bucks on you at 12 to 1.
Garrity noticed a few sawdusty lengths of telephone pole in the back of the truck. They were the ones who had made sure he was going to keep going, whether he liked it or not. He raised 1 hand to them and crossed the bridge. The tailgate that had replaced the butt planks clunked under his shoes, and then the bridge was behind them. the road dog-legged, and the only reminder of the rest they'd almost had was a wedge-shaped swath of light on the trees at the side of the road. Soon, that was gone, too. "Has a long walk ever been stopped for anything?" Harkness asked.